have come so far, so far from home. We have come so far, so far to go. Hey there, Kayla.
Hi, Blake.
We're right back here on our favorite podcast, Under the Arch.
Is your favorite podcast?
I mean, it is my favorite podcast.
Okay, that's good to
know. Is it not your favorite podcast?
I mean, I just think I don't want this to come off vain, you know? Like, my favorite podcast is the one where I hear my own voice. It's a little weird, but it's top two and it's not the two. I'll say that.
Okay, well, listeners, we hope this is your favorite podcast. Welcome back to Under the Arch, a podcast where we discuss the issues facing our communities and the people fighting to transform them. And we are continuing in that vein today. There's so much happening in St. Louis right now. This week is kind of, in our work, is quite a week. We're not going to go down that road today. Maybe sometime soon we'll talk about the latest shenanigans in our work. But
shenanigans is the right. And it's not us. We are not the people
not us.
Perpetuating the shenanigans.
Mm-mm, listen, and we're over here just trying to do our part.
Just trying to bring more justice and equity to the city of St. Louis. Just a little bit, one day at a time, you know, and make sure people are staying in environmentally friendly neighborhoods, not hazardous, contaminated jail sites. Mm-hmm. You said we'll talk about it later. So
yeah, we'll talk about it later. But you said a magic word there though, which is neighborhoods. We use words like communities and neighborhoods, or even place all the time. It's embedded in how we think about, I think, social justice and how we think about racial justice, and some of the kind of animating forces behind our work and all of our collective work. But there's an element to that that really in our day-to-day, in our organizations, we don't really focus on, which is like, how do the people in communities, how do the people in neighborhoods shape at a material level, like what that physical space looks like, feels like, how they are interacting with each other, which is obviously critical to everything that we care about.
Yeah, I think that's important because, you know, we talk about building transformed communities, more just communities, and we want people, when you think about St. Louis's history and neighborhoods, and especially, like, I grew up in North City, how policy decisions have been made have drastically impacted our ability to build community and be in community. And so families are making decisions based on their lived environment that's often changed by things like policy. And so I'm excited for this episode because it is something we don't talk about a lot inside of our organizations, but we are, you know, friends with our guest this episode.
Yes.
She's just brilliant.
She's so brilliant. You know, we have so many brilliant friends. And this is one of our brilliant friends who I feel very privileged to know and to get to work with and to get to learn from. And, you know, she is working in a space where, you know, we definitely want to get into this. But I think that, you know, people who are oriented around social and racial justice, like, have been underrepresented in the space where she works and where she has so much knowledge and expertise. So I've been wanting to get her on this podcast for a while, and she's here now.
Yes, she is.
Can't get away. No, don't leave. Don't leave. You're here. She's Dara Eskridge. I'm going to read Dara's bio, which there's so much to be said, but Dara Eskridge is the CEO of Invest STL. As an urban planner and architect with a focus on centering the voices of communities of color in policy design, strategy development, and impact measurement, Dara works to advance opportunities to build wealth and power in Black and other racially and economically marginalized communities through equitable development and investment practices. Prior to Invest STL, Dara served as St. Louis Director of Operations for the national nonprofit Urban Strategies. Senior Planner in the St. Louis County Executive's Office of Strategy and Innovation, Senior Planner in St. Louis County Planning, in the City of St. Louis Homeless Services, the Housing Authority of the City of Bridgeport, Connecticut, and as a designer in a small architecture firm. So she is deeply experienced in this work. Dara earned her graduate degree in urban planning from Columbia University in New York and her Bachelor of Architecture from Tuskegee University in Alabama. And she's a lead accredited professional for neighborhood development. We're so happy to have her here. Welcome to Under the Arch, Dara.
Thank you. I need to update that bio. It's a lot of words.
It's a lot of words because you do a lot of things.
That's right. Exactly. How can you capture Dara in a bio? So instead, we're going to talk to you for a while and try to capture the essence of that work over the next however long. For those, you know, Kayla and I obviously have the privilege of knowing you. For those who do not know you, give us a little bit of your origin story. Like, how did you come into the work that you do now? And we're definitely going to ask you to sort of define that work more. But like, how did you get to where you are today and get into doing the kind of work that you do today?
I love this question because I get it a lot and I feel like I've been giving the wrong answer for a while. And I've just discovered that the answer is really about joy. You know, I think historically I've talked about all of the things that I've witnessed as being, you know, Black growing up in St. Louis, being all across St. Louis's Black neighborhoods, you know, the property losses, the bad transportation planning that affected us. But I just realized that it is actually the joy of being in Black spaces and Black communities that drives me into this work. Because the headlines that we see regionally or even nationally about St. Louis, and particularly about Black communities in St. Louis, is so much about despair and destruction. And I realized that doesn't add up to the experience that I had in my own Black neighborhoods here, right? I remember them being spaces of, you know, neighbors working together to solve both small and big things. I remember feeling comforted in these spaces of having meals and going to church and riding bikes until the lights came on, you know, all very, very happy, joyful, warm things. And I think what really drives me into this work is wanting to remind both my people and the broader community of what it actually means to be in a Black community and what kind of power and magic and dreams they hold. But on the long end of it, you know, I'm Bobby and Melody's daughter. And so that meant that I got to grow up with two incredibly brilliant and creative people that exposed me to entrepreneurship and nonprofit work and kind of civic life from a very early age, and just kind of learning from, you know, being near them throughout my life, and certainly like my father, who eventually became a real estate agent. And so spending lots of time in the passenger seat with him, driving across St. Louis, learning about different neighborhoods, seeing the differences in the landscape. And that, I think, started to spark some of the questions that I now try to answer in my work.
Yeah, thank you for that. I think, you know, what feels so true to me from what you said is this idea of like Black joy in community. And we tell the story of like growing up in places and hearing words like divested, neglected, but really inside of those communities, there's so much care, there's so much love, there's so much joy. And your work really helps to bring out what is the possibility in expanding those things as we make neighborhoods whole. So for folks who have not heard of Invest STL, or may not be as familiar with it, can you talk about the mission of the organization where you are in leadership?
Sure. So at Invest STL, we facilitate investment in the power of people and their neighborhoods to create communities of justice and opportunity in places that continue to endure the legacy of anti-Black systemic racism. And so that means that we are a part funder, right? We are a direct investor in Black neighborhoods. We also support other people and institutions in intentionally directing investment to these communities. It also means that we are working with the community and economic development ecosystem itself and all of its major actors and trying to shepherd or align the field so that it is adding up to a system that is responsive to the needs and desires and being willing to be led by people within their neighborhoods. It also means that we take a lot of big swings. We're, you know, taking a lot of risks, trying new things to model different ways of approaching this work. And then at the end of it all, it's about really resetting the narratives that we have about Black neighborhoods, because it is really, particularly in this region, the stories that we tell ourselves about our neighborhoods drives where we work, where we play, where we invest, and in many instances, especially when it comes to like North City and North County, what places and what people we want to avoid at all costs. And so we have to reshape, reframe the understanding of who's in these communities and what they're working with, who's kind of keeping them from opportunity, and what's the path forward.
So I want to ask a question about the kind of terminology of the field with a bit of a wind up, which is doubling as like a disclosure. So I met you in part when I was joining the board of Invest STL, which I'm very proudly a board member of Invest STL today. It's been a few years. I always forget exactly how long. But when I first met you, one of the things that I shared was that from my background as a generally nonprofit social justice lawyer, the words community development were kind of scary words in my world, because what they often meant were that, you know, for-profit entities were coming into a place, were investing, were looking to push out the poor and working class, typically Black or brown people in those communities, that it came with displacement, that it came with gentrification. And, you know, what I understood early on is that your work is in part kind of a reaction to that and a counter to that tendency in the field. And so, you know, all of that is a wind up in part to ask you to kind of unpack these terms that we hear in this field. So I'll say a few that have come up already: community development. And I just heard you say community and economic development. Maybe, I don't know if that's one, if that's two things. Another that I hear a lot in Invest STL's work is neighborhood planning. And I know, among other things, you are a planner. And then maybe the third, I'll just put three on the table, would be equitable development, maybe as a response to traditional community development. So can you just talk a little bit about like the language and what it means, the importance of it?
I appreciate you asking me to unpack the language, because it's, you know, it's just kind of part of the work now. And sometimes I forget that these words don't actually mean anything to most people. So I'll start from the top. Community development has kind of a broad definition. And so if you look it up, there's not real alignment around a single definition, but it is generally, you know, these notions of there's a collection of people, actions, and resources that are supposed to be working to the benefit of the public good for a particular place. And the scale of that place can vary, but for Invest STL's work, the scale of the place is the neighborhood. Economic development is a part of community development, but we've had this thing, you know, probably in the last 30 to 40 years in the history of this work, where they started to diverge, where we started to understand economic development to mean things particularly about jobs and revenue generated by commercial activities. And then they started to be treated differently, where economic development is kind of elevated from community development, right? Community development is, you know, it's grassroots work, it's small investment, you know, necessitated. Economic development is the things that bring the big dollars. And, you know, it also brings a lot more navy blue suits and glasses and things like that. But they're really, economic development is of community development, because thriving neighborhoods have hyperlocal economies that also need to be planned and invested in. Neighborhood planning is, in the simplest form, really people coming together to design what the future, what the vision of their neighborhood will be. And so they're looking, they're taking stock of what do they have, what do they enjoy, what are some trouble spots, and how do they want to solve for those? And what is the next like 10 years or 20 or even longer look like? And neighborhood plan, you know, there's a generally a product that comes out of it, right? A plan that has like a roadmap of actions to get to the vision. But most importantly, it's about the process. And I think also kind of like with economic development in the last 30 to 40 years, neighborhood planning became about the plan and not about the process and how we care for people in the process and whose voices are heard in that process. And so that's a lot of the work that we try to reverse now at Invest STL. And then finally, equitable development. So traditionally, Blake, I think you kind of hinted at this in the tee up to the question. In development work, we have traditionally seen, you know, there will be some outside force that has intentions on a place, whether it's a whole community or a parcel or a building, whatever. And they carry out their intentions. And whoever developed that thing is usually the one who benefits the most. If we're lucky, you might get some check the box community engagement or outreach before the thing is built so that they can say, well, I talked to people and, you know, they'll try to justify how whatever they created was asked for because, you know, maybe one or two people out of the 100 people that they talked to said they wanted that thing. But equitable development means that, again, we're focused on the process. In the best case scenario, what is being created is being generated from that neighborhood, right? So it is the idea of the people who are there, or at least it is them driving how that looks, what it will be. And then through the process, they're shaping it. And then ultimately, it's being designed so that the benefit of what is created is going to that neighborhood and the people who are there. They are the primary beneficiaries, and any external partners definitely like secondary beneficiaries of it.
Yeah, thank you. That's super helpful.
Yeah, and,
that's super helpful.
It is. It's super helpful. And I think I learned like three things in that, because I appreciate breaking those down. And I'm wondering if you can sort of give an example of a really like, and it doesn't even have to be in St. Louis, but an example of a development or a planning process that went well by those definitions, that was really thinking about the community, and perhaps a development example that didn't sort of align with equitable outcomes and community-centered visions.
So instead of doing a look back, I'd like to use one current effort to talk about, you know, how decisions could add up that could make it either inequitable or inequitable development. So let's look at NGA, right? So the National Geospatial Intelligence Agency, their new Western headquarters being located in the city, right, at Cass and Jefferson. It's a very large building. It's sitting on a lot of land that used to hold a lot of other things, including families, including, you know, small shops and laundromats that were being powered by residents whose families had lived in this neighborhood for generations, right? So now it's just a big parcel of land with a big building. They're trying hard to make it not fortress-like, but, you know, good luck when you're the federal government. And there are, to start, about 3,000 people who will be working on this campus. Now, years ago, when the federal government was shopping around for a location for this campus, you know, you heard local government saying, oh man, if we get this, it's a slam dunk for our communities. And I remember sitting in early conversations saying, it's not a slam dunk unless we make it so. because it could very easily just be an island of activity with 3,000 people who flow in from, you know, down Salisbury or Jefferson, go in there from 8 to 5 and then flow right out. And not a dollar is spent or invested in that neighborhood other than on that campus. If we allow that trajectory to continue, that will be inequitable development. Because to make that development happen, it had to take a lot from the existing community, from both land and property, but also memories and connection. It also required assembling a lot of parcels, which meant that other people didn't have opportunity to get to those properties and create something for themselves. So in many ways, it did. It was an extraction of the local resources, the hyper-local resources of that neighborhood, purely for the benefit of this agency and their contractors and the 3,000 people who almost none of them will, you know, be able to drive right down the street and sleep at night because they're going somewhere else. That would be an inequitable development. Mm. Now, to make this an equitable development, the slam dunk that many of our region's leaders said it would be requires that one, in the siting, how they build out that site, they really do seriously need to think hard about making sure it is a visible campus. It is one that is not cut off from the rest of the community. It is one that feels of the community and not a thing that's trying to define the community, both in physical presence, but also in the programming and use of the space. Two, there has to be a really intentional effort around really kind of touching who all is still there in that community from like a resident standpoint and seeing what dreams do they have? What things have they been trying to get off the ground that they've not been able to, that maybe this is the opportunity for it. When you've got 3,000 people who are flowing in and out, and then, you know, any number of national or international visitors on a recurring basis, you need restaurants, you need, you know, little shops, you need entertainment, you need all kinds of things. If we're smart, we will tap into that local community and say, all right, who's got dreams? Who's got plans? Who's got expertise? Let's get you a storefront. Let's get that business plan. Let's make the investment so that you can go ahead and anchor all of the commercial activity that's going to be here. So that while, you know, we built this big campus, at the end of the day, the investment is really right back into this neighborhood for the people who have been holding it down for generations. Mm-hmm. And then the third thing is, and I kind of hinted at this earlier, is that campus is just a component of the neighborhood, right? I remember a couple years ago, there was lots of talk around the NGA communities, the NGA neighborhoods. And I finally just had to tell people, wait a minute. These neighborhoods have been here. NGA is about to become a neighbor to these neighborhoods. And so it's not the NGA neighborhoods. It's the set of neighborhoods that NGA is privileged to call their home. That reframing matters, and how that shows up from a placekeeping standpoint will matter in whether or not, you know, along with the economic pieces of it and the visibility pieces of it, whether or not this is equitable development. And the jury is definitely still out, because all that we've seen so far, for the most part, is attention to NGA and what they need from an infrastructure standpoint. And I'll wrap this up in just a moment, but you know, I live in High Park. And so my children go to Gateway Elementary on Jefferson, right next to the NGA campus, which means every single day, I'm going on to Salisbury, passing up that campus, dropping my kids off to school, continuing down Jefferson to then go to my office. Now, for 7 years of having this home over here, I had to drive down really crappy roads, you know, like a pothole every 2.5 feet. Watching kids having to walk in the street because the sidewalks weren't contiguous anymore. In the last year, that route is getting smoother and smoother. And it's not because I live here. It's not because my neighbor who has been here for 20 years lives here. It's because NGA now lives here. And so that's the other side of how we make sure development is equitable. We start to care for and tend to the needs of those who have always been there before we start caring and tending to the needs of somebody who's just now coming.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for that. That was great. But no, I think this is a really helpful frame because we are watching, you know, when you think about, I almost wrote a question down about like ARPA money. And when we hear all this sort of like, we need to develop in order to put St. Louis back on the map, we need these sorts of developments, these huge, you know, big institutions coming into community. And we need to, when you hear about things like we need to reinvest north of Del Mar, there's not a real explanation of how we protect and improve the lives of the communities that exist. A lot of times we're thinking about this sort of extractive dynamic that happens where we are removing people from land and then building these sort of huge containment businesses, developments that don't relate to their neighbors in any real way.
Yeah, and it's both, you know, what I hear in that example is that it's both about sort of conceptual frameworks, mental models, and then about material investment, about policy decisions. Even in your saying, you know, it requires land and property, but it also is stripping memories and relationships. And like, the juxtaposition of that, or maybe the combination of that, it just strikes me as so powerful and something that is so rare to hear in these conversations. So we definitely want to stay there, and we have to take a break. We're going to go to our music minute. And on the other side of that, we will be back with more from Dara. You are listening to Under the Arch.
I was caught up in the days, dreaming of some far off place that I made up. Too many days I felt so cold, falling in another hole, can't seem to break out. I just want some freedom today. I don't care or know how, it's okay. I'm fighting for the freedom today. I don't care or know how, it's okay.
Welcome back. Hope you enjoyed our music minute. That was Freedom by Monk. You can find Monk's music on all streaming platforms. And we are still the Under the Arch podcast. And we are talking to Dara Eskridge, CEO of Invest STL, about all things community development, what is and what is not community development. And before we went to our music minute, you were using the NGA as an example of how we should be thinking and the questions we should be asking about development. And, you know, while we were on break, no surprise here, people, we kept talking. And I want to bring some of that break conversation into the podcast because we've seen a lot of development and we've seen a lot of resources in recent years come into the region to spur development.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that I think comes through so clearly in that NGA example is it is very often the things that people sort of talk about with excitement, that we're supposed to get excited about these like fancy new developments and projects. Sometimes you hear this around like sports stadiums, for example. It's very often entertainment venues that are supposed to be signs of economic activity and signs of investment. But what I hear you really drawing out quite beautifully is like, we really don't talk about the costs of that. We really don't talk about the costs to the people and communities that pre-exist, that predate those fancy, exciting new developments. And so I'm wondering if you can like say a little bit more of, because you've said some of this in the context of NGA, but I know that is not an isolated example. So like when we look at the history of development in St. Louis, when we look at what that has wrought, like what are the macro trends here? What are the macro trends in terms of, you know, massive investment, and then what has been sort of lost and extracted and stripped away?
Yeah. So the macro trends are someone with a lot of power says that, you know, this community, this big, broader community needs something or could benefit from something. You know, they're talking about like St. Louis at large. And they pick a place where that thing can go. And 99% of the times, that place is a Black community in St. Louis.
Yeah.
And then they level it, they destroy it, they send people scattering, and they build whatever it was that they were intended to build. And then we generally find that, you know, in about a generation's time, if we're lucky, but usually it's less time than that, whatever the thing was that they said we really needed, that they then demolished a whole community for, is no longer the thing that we needed. And then we just are left with a lot of unfulfilled promises. And in the midst of that, we've gotten rid of an entire community, but then we've set those individual families back because we've ripped them of their, you know, monetary and physical assets. We've ripped them of the connections that they had in their community with their neighbors. We've ripped them of the place that they understood as, this is home, this is comfort, this is joy. And we forced them to create different and new kind of ways of being that may not be totally serving them in the way that their previous home did. And we end up losing a lot of historical understanding as well of these people and the places that they occupied. You know, when you try to look up information about Deep Morgan, or even Mill Creek, which is one that has, you know, is spoken about more than others, it's still really difficult to get a full picture of who all was there. What were they doing? What was life like?
Yeah.
You know, what did they care about? What were the kind of the nodes that they all like to gather around? So there's a lot that we lose in that process for very, very little gain. And I'm not saying just for the people who were scattered, but for the region as a whole. I mean, we look at where Mill Creek was. What was said was needed for there, only about half of that was actually ever created. And look at Midtown. Like, you know.
Yeah.
There's some things happening, but there's not enough happening to justify getting rid of 22,000 people.
Yeah.
Right. For Topgolf.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I'm being facetious, but that is the kind of, it's like, yeah, well, let's put some entertainment, you know, industry in this place now. I know we want to sort of turn to, you know, Invest STL enters this context and like what is the impact in that context that you're trying to have. But as we do that, I do just want to draw listeners. You're reminding me of a couple of previous conversations we have had. I see Kayla's nodding like she was thinking the same thing. I'm thinking about the Walter Johnson conversation where we talked about a number of neighborhoods, including Mill Creek. And, you know, he has this theme around extraction, which I hear so much in what you're saying, Dara. And the other is with Gwen Moore, Ms. Gwen Moore, who was on this podcast, who is an oral historian at the Missouri History Museum, who was a native of Mill Creek and talked about that experience in her own life. So if you didn't listen to those, I would suggest you go back because, you know, you can hear this thread.
Yeah, it also makes me think about, you know, as the chair of this reparations commission right now in St. Louis, one of the real sections of the report that we've talked about is this like neighborhood divestment and what has all the way through to sort of extraction and erasure and the consequences of that and the material consequences of like family. I can't go to grandmother's house. Grandmother's house isn't in the family anymore. We're not generating wealth because we're not passing assets down through generations in the same way that other communities are able to do because complete neighborhoods have been removed, right? And deemed invaluable in real ways. And so I think that's a piece of it. And then what that does to an economy, like what we heard in Mill Creek, too, for the services that were provided and the businesses that existed, and how hard it is to sort of find these local economies, as you mentioned, these like neighborhood economies that exist anymore because of this sort of layered removal and divestment. And that has happened a lot in St. Louis. It's happened a lot everywhere, but St. Louis has a really unique sort of place. And you start to almost ponder the question when you sort of see a large development like Brentwood and, you know, like these huge places, what was there before? And, or, you know, even highways, what was there before? Black communities were there before. Arch, what was there before, you know? Mm-hmm. And so we constantly have seen the story of removal for the sake of development, and who does that benefit? I think is a real question. And so, yeah, we should bring in what Invest STL is doing about that.
Enter Invest STL. Yes, right. So you, in addition to being a planner and thinker about these things, you like run an institution. And so there's a program that is trying to intervene in helpful ways. So can you like unpack then how does Invest STL go about that?
Yeah, there's a lot. There are lots of pieces to this, and we enter it through the relationships that we want to cultivate within neighborhoods and making investments there. So over these last few years, you know, we've been partnered in the West End of Visitation Park neighborhoods and Dutchtown neighborhoods, working very closely with the community development corporations there to support them in really anchoring themselves as a body that can then support residents in really setting the agenda for their place and driving it forward, right? So that means we're investing in that institution. We're investing in these resident-led efforts like resident-led planning, which happened in the West End. And then investing in the implementation of those dreams and those plans. And these are long-term relationships, right? And so we're now entering year 6, I think, with those neighborhoods and gearing up to invest and start new investment partnerships in other neighborhoods. And so that's one way that we approach the work. It's, you know, being in very close relationship. Actually, the partners, the team members on our team who hold those relationships the closest, their title is Neighborhood Solidarity Partner. And we mean every single word of that, right? We're not there to dictate, well, because we're investing, you must do X, Y, Z. The money, the investment is really a method for creating time and space for the neighborhood and its actors to be able to think and to dream. Because we often do not have that space. We're constantly in the motion of, okay, I have to chase this dollar just to stay alive, or, you know, I just got to do this thing because that's what local government says. Uh-huh. And so this is really thinking and dreaming money. And then ultimately it's kind of organizing support, right? Because now they got the time and the space to then go and round up all the people and build what we call a neighborhood operating system. So they understand, how do we relate to each other? What is the agenda we want to set? And then how do we go ahead and move forward on it? And then how do we pull on these levers within the region that can get us what we want? How do we navigate all this? Because it's a maze. If you don't know what all the acronyms mean, where all the pots of monies are, good luck. So through that neighborhood investing, that is a piece of the work. And as we're in relationship with neighborhoods, you know, we start to learn about what they care about, what's been giving them issues, what kind of trends they're seeing, right? We were kind of on the edge of talking about gentrification a few minutes ago, and that's how efforts like Rooted come into being, right? Because we had been sitting with the West End of Visitation Park residents for a couple of years and heard, you know, as they were embarking on their neighborhood planning process, this recurring concern that there are a lot of things happening on the perimeter of that neighborhood. And they're excited to see it. They're excited to see what's happening. And also, right, they've got collective memory of what this kind of activity looks like for Black communities in St. Louis, right? They're starting to see the early signs of, oh, wait a minute, that street's not being paid for me, right? Those trees are not planted for me. In fact, they were cut down, you know, 5 years ago. And so they're starting, the concern starts to creep into that this may no longer be a place for me. This may no longer be a Black neighborhood, even though it's been a Black neighborhood for five generations because our families were displaced from Mill Creek. And so kind of having that on the ground understanding within the neighborhoods, hearing from residents, that led us into developing Rooted, which is looking at direct household level investment as an anti-displacement strategy, right? How do we support existing families and people within this community to be able to continue to be within this neighborhood, not be ousted, be able to reinvest within themselves within this neighborhood, and be able to benefit from the economic upturn that the neighborhood is certainly headed towards? And so that's a piece of the work too, right? So it is that just very relational work at the neighborhood level. And then it's the, okay, we hear you, let's try something and let's see if this works. And that's where kind of at our core, we're really a learning lab. We're going to try a lot of things because we know what doesn't work. Let's try to figure out what does, learn from it, share it out, and then motivate others to try it as well. Ultimately, so we can try and shape these things into actual policy moves. And then in the context of all of this, like I said before, is the storytelling piece of it. So we are now embarking on the process of creating what we're calling a neighborhood storytelling practice. Because one, as I mentioned, the headlines in this region about Black neighborhoods are atrocious. I have a very bad habit of actually tracking headlines. So I'll wake up and I'm looking on, you know, all the local media, and I will see the very same incident happen, but in two different places. And depending on where they're happening, the reporting on it is very different, yeah. Right? So if a car is broken into in Hyde Park, I will see car break-in in North City. If a car is broken into Tower Grove, I will see car broken into on South Kings Highway. What is the difference here?
Right. The implication of an entire.
The implication of an entire sub-region of our city.
Yeah.
And really what it is an implication of having things around Black people. So building that neighborhood storytelling practice is an opportunity first to just support residents in these neighborhoods and understanding that you've got more to the story. You know more of the story. So speak it out loud for yourself. And then if you're so inclined, because your story is also worthy of being memorialized, then let's also look at sharing it if you want to.
Yeah. I mean, I'm thinking about, I'm going to go back a bit to the Rooted example. I mean, I think Rooted in that idea of targeted investments in places that are getting these external investments. Like, it's such a fascinating intervention and a fascinating policy experiment, or, you know, you're doing it at the level of program, but potentially a policy experiment, because, you know, we hear and read quite a bit about, in the logic of like American racial capitalism, the presence of Black people. There's a lot of evidence that the mere presence of Black people in spaces brings down property values, like literally makes a place less expensive, less valuable. And that is, you know, that obviously has ties going back many generations. And part of what I hear you saying is like the intervention being offered here is, well, if we just can keep people where they are, if we can like get them the resources to just keep them where they are, while these outside forces pour in investment, then that itself is a wealth building strategy. Then that itself is how we preserve the assets that the Black residents there have, which has a lot of, like, intuitively, that makes a ton of sense to me. And also, I guess, like, how do you prevent the first thing I said? You know, how do you prevent the people that are pouring in the money from sort of saying, oh man, not enough of these folks are leaving? You know, like, am I just being too pessimistic about it? Like, how do you deal with that other macro force that tends to act in such anti-Black ways?
So that's where it's not a solve-all, but that's where neighborhood plans become a preventive measure, because then it's the roadmap for the kind of investment that the community wants, and it's directing dollars to those actions. And it's also, in a really good neighborhood plan, it's laying out, and here's where the negotiations need to occur. Here's who you need to be sitting at the table with before you spend a penny.
Yeah. I think about that. I think about a neighborhood plan also as just a tool of accountability, right? That, like, it holds both electeds accountable to their residents' voices, where oftentimes we hear a representative misrepresent the actual desires of communities in these conversations toward landing this development in a ward or a place. And, you know, there is something really important about it being in Black and white on paper, right, that you can sort of source and see the process by which this plan came to be, so that it's also transferring knowledge for folks who maybe were not as involved to have a resource to sort of defend and hold accountable these powers that are sort of like coming into community. And I think organized people matter so much more sometimes than organized money in these moments, in these conversations. I think that's really a testament to what you're seeing in both, like, these neighborhoods that Invest STL is working in.
Yeah, I love that you said that organized people matter more than the organized money, because in its best representation, a neighborhood plan is an organizing tool, right? It is the thing that allows residents and local government and outside investors and developers and CDCs and neighborhood associations to all see, okay, this is the play. This is what we got to do. This is the role, you know, each of us has to play in this and bringing this forward.
Just as a follow-up, how does Invest STL go about choosing its neighborhoods or choosing the neighborhoods to partner with? Like, what's the math on that?
All right. So I have to give you backstory to answer that question.
Yeah.
Invest STL was founded around 2012 by a group of volunteers who were really responding to HUD requiring the city of St. Louis to create a different formula for distributing block grant dollars. Up to that point, block grant dollars had kind of been doled out between the different alders, and then, you know, each alder kind of had their own process for issuing those grants. Or at least naming who should get the grants. HUD came in and said, yep, nope, that's not ethical. And that drove city government to move to the competitive process for block grant dollars that they use now. And so while that, you know, fixed one challenge, it created an unintended consequence in that there were fewer dollars being dedicated towards neighborhood level work. Because then those block grant dollars started to go towards, like, large scale development, like affordable housing, things that are certainly important, but it's not that, you know, block by block neighborhood level kind of power building and activation work. And so that was the motivation for creating Invest STL, because in other regions, there's a body like an Invest STL that is pooling together funding for neighborhood work and then distributing it. So InvestSEO kind of had operated with that premise for, you know, several years as a volunteer organization. And it was in 2019 that, you know, after a campaign, they were able to finally hire staff. I think for like a lot of organizations, 2020 presented an opportunity to kind of be introspective and really think about who are we, what's our DNA, why do we exist? And that starts to be the turning point for us in considering what is our real purpose in this region, in this ecosystem. What do we mean by place matters and doing place investment, place-based investment? And that's how we zeroed in on this very succinct mission around investing in the power of people in their neighborhoods. With that also came the decision to sunset this organization. And so we made a commitment that we're going to run this race fast and hard for 20 years at most. We're going to give it everything that we can to try to create or help shape an ecosystem that is willing to be led by residents in Black neighborhoods and be responsive to their direction so that they are building the kinds of communities that are worthy of their lifetimes. And for us, that's about a generation's worth of work. So that clock started ticking in 2022. We've got till 2042 at most to achieve that work, which means that we have to be super smart and discerning in how we use all the resources, our people, our time, our money, our energy, all of these things. And so when it comes down to the question of how do we select places to invest in, we actually just went through this process over the last, you know, 6 months or so, looking at, okay, limited time by choice, limited resources, limited bandwidth, where do we focus? And we ultimately decided that the answer, or at least we're guided to the answer from our mission. And there's this notion around legacy, right? And so we start to look at what's the legacy of Black neighborhoods within this region. And for us, we're defining legacy as a community, a neighborhood has to have at least two generations worth of Black people existing in it. So that's about 40 years. Then we start to look at, okay, what has been the patterns of anti-Black policy making that have impacted the place? And can we see a direct line from that policy making to the community as it exists today? And then that helps us really just kind of narrow in and, okay, there are a set of neighborhoods between the city and St. Louis County and just across the river that these are the places that we will conceivably invest in over our lifetime. These are legacy Black neighborhoods that we know have been impacted by anti-Black policies and that on the whole have been intentionally cut out of investment and other opportunities for at least the last 40 years, but in many cases, much longer than that.
Yeah. Wow.
Yeah, I have to say, I've seen you move through this. And what I really appreciate, you and the team at InvestSTL, and I think you used the word rigorous a minute ago, and like, you and the team really are so rigorous in how you make decisions and how you gather information and analyze that information. I mean, a lot of what we're talking about, some of what we've been talking about today is sort of, you know, it's like in an emotional register. But what I really appreciate is that you're sort of combining that with this analytical rigor that says like, no, we also got to get it right. And I think that's so important because the effort to create these conditions of inequity have been rigorous efforts, rigorous and precise and intentional efforts. And it takes a counter effort that is equally, if not more, rigorous and precise and intentional. So I just really appreciate that. What in the your time with Invest STL to date, what have you seen that gives you the most hope when you think about that 20, now 18 year time horizon and the ambitious goal over that period of time? Like, what gives you hope and makes you believe that we can get there?
It's the moment when I see somebody push back. That's what gives me the hope. What I am observing in this work, doing it in this way, is that there's a lot of unlearning that has to happen. Even for people who come into the work, whether it's, you know, our team members, consultants, or residents, right? Even if we're all saying, you know, equitable development, power building, centering residents, white supremacy culture is a real thing. And so for for those of us who come in with that equity mindset, we are still practiced in white supremacist ways. And so the amount of unlearning that it takes to do this work well and with care is a lot. And when I get to observe the movement that someone is making in that process, because they're coming out of the old ways of being and now they're emerging into this new way of being where they truly are understanding, like, oh no, wait a minute, this is my neighborhood. I can speak up right now and I can make that consultant wait while I speak up right now because this is what needs to happen because this is my home. You know, getting to that point when a year before they wouldn't speak up at all because they thought they had to ask permission after the meeting to then be able to say something in the next meeting. That's what gives me hope, because now we're seeing that at all the levels, right? We're seeing that with residents. We're seeing that with CDCs in their own way. And now we're even starting to see it with local government, right? Where they are kind of picking up some of the practices that have been tried. And that is deeply encouraging, because it's not about, the work isn't about the money. It's not about the physical things that get built. It's really actually not even about the plans. It's about the practice making and the understanding that we have to do this work differently, and it is totally possible to do this work differently, and the willingness for people to join in on it and just keep trying and building up that muscle for it.
As an organizer, that is hopeful, to watch people be transformed in their own journeys and willing to take that step toward, you know, defending their communities and advocating for their own visions. I think that's really powerful, and also gives me hope, gives us hope every day inside of the work that we do. Okay, as we prepare to land the plane that is episode 2 of season 5 of Under the Arch, just a vision question, right? So Invest STL does this for 20 years inside of an ecosystem with so many other orgs fighting for justice and equity and all these things. What does St. Louis look like if we get this right?
I'm less concerned about what it looks like and far more concerned about what it feels like. Mm-hmm. Like I said, we've given ourselves a generation to do this work. And like all things that matter, it comes back to the personal. But for all the things that Blake read in my bio, I'm a mother. I've got a son who is 9 named Theo, a daughter who is 7 named Ray. And right when we finish this work, they will be emerging into this world with their own responsibilities and their own choices to make about what the rest of their life looks like and where they want to root themselves. And I want St. Louis to feel like a place that can be theirs. that can be their forever home if they wanted it to, that feels like a place that is full of opportunity for all of their imagination.
Wow, that's beautiful.
Amen. Amen. Well, Dara, I'm so glad that you spent this hour with us, that you said yes and came on Under the Arch, and that our listeners are going to get to hear from you. I think you just have such a unique and important perspective. And, you know, listeners, among other things, Dara is just humble to a fault. And so I sometimes have to beg her to let us hear all of the brilliance. And we're so glad we got to hear that brilliance from you today. It really is inspiring and also just educational. Learned a lot from you today, and hope others did as well. So thank you. Thank you for being here, and thank you for all the work you're doing and will continue to do. And you know, we'll be there.
Deep gratitude for you joining us. Also, just need to very quickly ask, if folks are like, this is the work for me, I live in this neighborhood and I didn't know about this, or I live in the city and I didn't know about this, how can folks find out more? Where should they go? How do they plug in? Is a regular question we always ask.
Thank you for asking. You can go to our website at investsdl.org. We are not Invest St. Louis. That's somebody's grown-up organization. We're Invest SDL. You can also follow us on Instagram and Facebook and LinkedIn. And we have a couple of job opportunities coming up too. So growing our team, but also if you want to get more involved in your neighborhood, you go onto our website, there's a neighborhood organizations map. You click on your neighborhood and you can see many of the organizations that are active in that footprint that you can start to work with.
Awesome. Thank
Love
you.
It. Love so it.
Much. Oh my God.
Okay. Thank that you was again.
Great. That was great. Okay. We are going to take a very quick break. And we again just want to thank Dara for joining us, and we will be back. You are listening to Under the Arch. All right, welcome back.
Right.
Oh, that was so good, Blake.
Yeah, I know. She's such a gem. She's such a gem.
Brilliant. As I said, brilliant. You know, my friend is like, that was so delicious. That was a delicious, scrumptious episode. I mean, just good in the sense of like informative and relevant and like powerful and hopeful and like just beautifully told. I'm so excited for listeners to hear this episode.
Yeah. I mean, I just feel like we get so intentionally, like we're made to be intimidated about things like economic development. It's like, oh, don't worry about that. That's not for you.
People at the table in a room far away. And like, no, it's not. It's your community.
Yes.
Your voice absolutely matters in that. And we should be involved in that and be thinking about and advocating for those who are often not at the table in these conversations to be the center voices in the work. And so, thanks again to our lovely guest, Dara Eskridge.
Check out Invest STL.
Shout out the whole Invest STL team and board, including you, Blake.
Oh, well. Thank you. All I do is like show up and listen to Dara say brilliant things like that. And then
that's what I do on headboard. You know, I just show up. And you know, we have passed trivia night, but we had a really fun.
Yeah, we did. And you were in rare form again.
Isn't it rare if you do it every year?
Okay. Oh well, you know, it's only once a year. It's like
only
Christmas.
Once a year. We Don't sang. We were singing. This was the trivia night.
It was like a sing along trivia.
It was a sing along. We had a good time. So if you were there, thank you always for supporting Arch City Defenders.
Yeah,
what a time. What a time. We should thank our team because our team is keeping this train moving.
They really are.
We want to thank Johnny. We want to thank Z. We want to thank Angelo. We want to thank Zoe. The whole Under the Arch squad.
Yes.
It takes a village. It truly takes a village to raise a podcast.
It really does.
And our music minute. Our music minute was by this brilliant artist Monk called Freedom. Again, you can find that where you listen to your music. Won't say which, you know, platform is better, but wherever you listen to your music, you can search Monk and listen to that song Freedom. Thank you, Monk, for allowing us to share that beautiful track with our listeners.
Yes, and speaking of freedom, special announcement.
Dun, 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 dun.
We have now officially announced that this year we are going to be doing a series of events under the banner Freedom Summer STL. So Arch City Defenders, Action St. Louis, a number of our community partners bringing together both resources, clinics, trainings, and then a collaborative rally and march throughout the months of June and July. The dates are going to be kicking off on Juneteenth, on June 19th, then Saturday, June 29th, Saturday, July 27th, and the rally will be on August 30th, and many more details to come about the when and where and what of it all, but it's built around four prongs: abolition, expungement, voter engagement, and then housing justice. So things that are really important to our organizations and to our partners in this community that has been, you know, just fighting for justice in St. Louis and that continues to fight for justice. So I'm really excited about that.
It is an election year, people. I don't, you know, and this episode is actually, you know, airing, if you're listening to it today, before 7 o'clock, polls are open. So go vote. Because it's an election day.
Wow, that's right. Tuesday release.
Elections matter. So do that. And then we have really important elections in August and November. And so we are going to be registering voters, educating folks, helping, providing the awesome services that Arch City Defenders is known for, and honoring our ancestors who paved the way through many Freedom Summers. These resources more available to our communities. And so if you're interested, if the people are like, oh snap, Freedom Summer STL coming 2024, where should they go, Blake?
You should definitely go to our website, go to archcitydefenders.org, look for Freedom Summer. There will be an interest form that you can fill out. And that way you'll be on our list. We can send you all of the updates as we know more details. And you can be fully in the loop. So we'll keep plugging as we go along. We'll tell you more and more information over the next several episodes about what to expect at Freedom Summer. But we're very excited and really excited to display again the network of partners, organizations, individuals that do such incredible work day in, day out in St. Louis, and we're happy to be a part of it. And yeah, I do want to underscore, like you said, it's the 60th anniversary of the original Freedom Summer in 1964. And so we're really building on that legacy and keeping that radical movement energy alive here in St. Louis. So very excited about that.
Absolutely. Well, now it's time to say goodbye.
Yes, it is. Yes, it is. This has been great.
This has been such a good episode. This is episode 2, y'all, of season 5. We are grateful that you have been with us for 5 seasons. Share this podcast.
Yes.
Follow us on all platforms. We're under
rate it,
share it, amplify it, tag us. Let us know if you agree, even if you disagree. We want to hear from you. And we are so grateful that you continue to listen to Under the Arch. And we will talk to you very soon.
Yeah, see you next time.
We have come so far, so far to go. Thank you.